Okay, got a little problem at the, on the start there. So, welcome to Expanding Mind. Not sure what happened there. We got to enjoy Mark Pilkington's lovely soundtrack in all of its glory, unmixed with my goofy voice. I've been thinking about how what has attracted me to subcultures over the years. I've often been really interested in seeing the meanings that people make out of popular music, out of dancing, out of gathering together, out of listening to records, out of thinking about popular culture. And, you know, I realize that there's a way in which people can invest themselves in their cultural production that really kind of pushes the possibilities of meaning, and for me, ultimately, towards a certain kind of sacred meaning. And I realized that whether it was like the Grateful Dead or black metal or psytrance or, you know, Star Trek fans, like a lot of the things that I was really interested in when I'd go to these gatherings, I'd go to shows, I'd go to festivals, I was really interested in how people made, like fans would make meaning, you know, in our often sort of meaningless world, real intense feelings, real intense senses of possibility and of connection. But over the years, as I went to more and more kind of, you know, festivals and gatherings in different zones of subculture, I became more and more interested with the people who were actually putting on the show, sort of how people were staging these experiences for other people rather than necessarily exactly how people were experiencing themselves. And this was particularly the case with a lot of the festivals I went to. I have had the good fortune of going to a lot of really excellent electronic music festivals, both large scale and small scale, mostly on the West Coast, but also the Great Boom Festival and in Portugal and other gatherings in the UK and other parts of the States. But particularly in the West Coast, I became super fascinated with how a certain blend of new electronic music, kind of older hippie vibes, but a younger energy that's mediated through digital technology and a kind of familiarity with the web, was creating this very rich, fascinating culture, neo-tribal culture, you can call it that. And if you're interested in more of my thoughts on that, I wrote some of the text for a really remarkable book of photographs by Kyra Wiltshire called Tribal Revival, where we really try to kind of give a snapshot of this very rich culture that people don't really pay very much attention to. And one of the main avenues I've had into that scene in terms of understanding it and sort of seeing the breadth of things that go on there is by through my friendship with our guest today, Eve Bradford, a.k.a. Lady Apples, who's been an event organizer, writer, performer, curator for many, many years, you know, working in, you know, loosely speaking, this kind of neo-tribal zone. And so I'm really happy to have her on the show. I haven't really talked to her very much for the last couple of years, and so I'm really looking forward to hearing what she's up to and what she has to say. But first, we're going to bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good. We were just saying you're not even though you're like into like astrology and witchcraft and you live in LA and all this stuff, you're not the most comfortable character at a neo-tribal gathering, are you?
It's true. The last time I went to Coachella, I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
Well, that's a different kind of, that's a different beast altogether in a lot of ways. But it's the patchouli that does it for you, right?
It's true. I mean, I went to the Evergreen State College, and although it was at a time when K Records and a lot of the indie punk music was amazing. I mean, like Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill was living there at the time, and there was all that going on the which I was interested. That was kind of like my scene, if you're gonna say that word. But then there was all the deadheads and like pseudo hippies at Evergreen, and they all had dreadlocks that were doused with patchouli, and they would have drum circles in these gatherings and these kind of events that were like that. And man, I guess it's stupid because it was all like trying to be nice and get together, but it would just make my skin crawl.
That's so funny, you know, because I grew up in going to dead shows, so all that's like mother's milk to me.
I know. I just couldn't stand it.
It's that old lullaby, you know. I love it, and then it's changed a lot. It's really transformed a lot. But with that, let's bring on Eve. Eve, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Excellent, excellent. Well, one thing I thought to start off just to give a little, you know, it's always nice to give a little biographical sketch, but one of the things that's always intrigued me about you and the work you do and the way you talk about it even in particular and think about it is that even though you've spent years on the West Coast and you're, you know, deeply embedded in a lot of really creative, really interesting scenes and, you know, tons of people, and you've really kind of, you know, you've built your life there in the West Coast, but you're also very much a New Yorker, and you came from New York, and you came with a certain kind of angle and a sort of sense of, well, you know, a different way of thinking about things that I think has really made your perspective on the West Coast scene really interesting. So I thought you might talk a little bit about, like, why you came West, what you brought with you, and how that kind of sort of shaped the way that you found yourself, you know, getting more and more into this really creative, interesting scene.
Great. Yeah, I was thinking about that, actually, as you guys were speaking about your own personal milieus. I, you know, before I was a New Yorker even, I was a Vermonter. And so, you know, I grew up in a cabin that my parents built with no electricity. So that was where I started. And, of course, needed to get as far from that as I could, you know, as quickly as possible. And so wound up in New York City for college. But before I got to New York City, after graduating from high school, I went and lived in New Orleans for a year. And that was a really seminal moment in the whole trajectory because I really learned about spectacle culture there and was completely fascinated by, in particular, brass band culture. I got really into brass band music when I lived there and was just fascinated by spectacle and by all of that. And then when I was at Gallatin, which is the School for Individualized Study at NYU, where I went to school, I you know, found out about the Society of Spectacle and, you know, started looking at more kind of people that had been thinking about these kind of things. Also, Hakim Bey and the Temporary Autonomy Zone was really important to me at that time, and I got really involved. It actually helped found a group called Reclaim the Streets in 1998 in New York City that was inspired by the UK movement of the same name. And we were throwing huge unpermitted dance parties in the middle of intersections to protest the privatization of public space under Giuliani. So the first parties I ever threw were actually those parties. It was, you know, blocking an intersection, having a sound system in the middle of the intersection with a van down the street that was transmitting a pirate radio frequency. The DJ was in the van transmitting a pirate radio frequency to the sound system in the middle of the crowd. So when the cops came to shut it down, everyone bought boom boxes. And when it would get shut down, everyone with their boom boxes turned their boom boxes to the pirate radio frequency, and the exact music they had just shut down started coming from like 1,000 different places in the crowd.
Oh my God, that is such a marvelous metaphor.
That's,
I love,
amazing.
Yeah, it was really, it's one of the high points of my life, I think, that moment. And so we did that for a lot of years, and I happened to graduate from college, you know, in 2000, so it was all this sort of like pre-9/11 activist world that changed a lot. Because suddenly we weren't activists anymore, we were domestic terrorists, you know, which hadn't really been a term that existed before 9/11. So things changed a lot after that, but I was out of there by then. But that was really where I started seeing the potential of gatherings and how they could really be working with the energy of a group, and just got all of this really amazing kind of boot camp in that. And at the same time, a lot of what I was studying in school was experimental performance theory. And I was really into all the weird 70s feminist performance artists and also like the living theater and, you know, just all of these characters who were really thinking about, you know, also Victor Turner and the, you know, the spectrum from ritual to theater and liminality, which is a whole other topic, that, but that's what I was studying at the time. So the combination of these kind of activist, you know, unpermitted illegal street parties and then the experimental performance theory, I would say those two things together are really the roots of where I'm coming from when
I'm
producing.
Well, that's very interesting. And I want to ask you, just because, like, for me, a lot of the kind of hippies at Evergreen, they were all part of deep ecology. Like, there was all these kind of deep ecologist propagandists that would go out trying to push flyers on you. And then when you say, like, you know, domestic terrorists, I mean, they were actually activists that would go and strap themselves to trees, and some of them got gnarly and would, you know, kind of spike trees that would cause lumberjacks to get injured, and there was a lot of kind of riots that would result of some of that. And I'm just curious, since you kind of came from that background, did you see any sort of exploitative aspect where some of these activist groups would go in places like colleges and they would try to kind of, like, predate upon some of the students to get them involved in some of this stuff and then kind of like have them join their cult a little bit? Did you ever feel anything like that, or were yours not really so much that way?
Not in the least. That feels like a completely, like, yeah, that doesn't feel like the world I was in at all. It was, I mean, we were throwing dance parties.
Right.
In the middle of intersections in the city. I mean, we used certain forced activism tactics. We made 30-foot aluminum pole tripods and someone climbed up into the middle of it to block the intersection, which is actually a tactic taken from forestry activism. But we were in the middle of, you know, the urban jungle. And so, you know, and I mean, the idea of like terrorist recruiting tactics just seems kind of absurd to me. I mean, it was not hard to have people want to come, like, party in the street because a community garden was about to get bulldozed. It's like pretty straightforward. There was a really amazing...
It seems like an important part is just the way that the dance and the cultural gathering can be a vehicle of change and you know, actual reorganization of social space that really, you know, impacts people in a way that's sort of parapolitical. It's like political but on the side, or it has political potential but it's not so directly linked to a specific kind of agenda, and that seems to be something that's an important kind of difference.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we were thinking about had to do with that we wanted to meet the negativity of what we were being faced with celebration. That was actually a huge part of where we were coming from. It was people that were actually kind of disillusioned with traditional protest methodology and really were excited to experiment with what happened when the cops are in front of you and you're dancing, you know? We had a lot of different experiences. We found out a lot depended on where you were. It was very different if you were at Astor Place in Broadway than if you were at Wall Street, you know. The tolerance level changed a lot. But definitely it was a lot about celebration as a kind of, like, strategy, really.
And so let's take it to the West Coast. When you came, you know, how did you, you know, sort of begin to recognize the potential, and what did you see that was sort of specific about, you know, let's call it neo-tribal. It's you know, these words are kind of get in the way sometimes too, but it's, you know, as good a handle as any.
Yeah, you know, I had the classic experience of, I was working at the Omega Institute in upstate New York and found myself at Burning Man for the first time and was like, okay, there they are. There are my people. I'm out of here, and moved to San Francisco that fall. And I was feeling really limited by certain aspects of the East Coast culture. And so it was actually, like, immediately upon getting to San Francisco, a friend of mine who I had worked with at Omega asked me to do this opening ritual for a Koinonia party that was being thrown at the Boonville Grange, and which is, you know, up in Mendocino County. So that was my first, like, West Coast party. I had been asked to do the opening ritual for this party, and I had no idea what I was stepping into. And you know, I actually have no love for psytrance. I have love for people who have love for psytrance, but it doesn't really work for me. So I was kind of put off immediately by that aspect of it, but I was really into how into it everybody was. I got really excited by the energy that I felt of people connecting and coming together and having common ground, and just, you know, kind of immediately got swooped into this whole culture that existed around that. And it was, and you know, a lot of it I think was because I was invited to do this opening ritual, so I had a place, I had something to do. And I think that's a big part of why I became a producer and a performer and, you know, curator, because I don't really enjoy being at events without something to do. And so I always wanted to be participating somehow in shaping what was happening, because I'm kind of a content junkie. And a lot of these events, for my level of preference, are lacking in content. And so that's always been kind of my angle, is like wanting to have what all this celebration is happening be in service to something, or be for something, or be about something. So, and I was always, you know, with my high youthful idealism and energy intact in those days, I really felt excited about helping shape what seemed like a culture where people had a lot of interest and availability to kind of coming together and finding out about things, learning about things, but I felt like it could really use some focus. And so that's
Can you give an example of one that you felt like really kind of failed in that respect, content-wise, that you attended?
Most of them. I mean, up into a point, like there was a wave where there was a whole kind of crew of us that, you know, there was kind of a wave. I don't even know what year was it, Eric. I guess it was like early 2000s, like 2002 to 2006, maybe in there, when there was this real kind of collective energy that was put into like imbuing events with content. And previous to that, it wasn't really about that.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think that people really don't see from the outside. I mean, they might understand, you know, dance parties in the woods and, you know, people getting ecstatic and, you know, a kind of tribal vibe and things like that. But unless people were really paying attention or going to these events, you know, and again, not just in the West Coast, I mean, Boom is another example, et cetera, and Burning Man too, where there was this higher bar place of intentionality and also of information sharing, of art sharing, a real grappling with the problem of how do you create some kind of ritual or sacred container that still honors the, like, the total sort of open-ended quality of a lot of the spirituality that people are bringing, where you can't just apply some old map onto it, and you need to kind of make it from all the bits and pieces that all these different kinds of people are bringing. And it was really about, you know, I remember even talking to you about what it is to create like a container. So you have all this energy at these events, you know, spiritual energy, hedonic energy, joy, you know, difficulties. But how do you create certain kinds of containers that lets that be focused and let people sort of call people to producing more content, to feeding back and not just, you know, enjoying it or having their own personal experience. So what were some of the ways that you approached, you know, with the crew, various crews, creating those kinds of containers in the festival or in the party environment?
Well, yeah, for me, I was always thinking about liminality. That was like my thing in those days. And, you know, Eric, you actually mentored me through a graduate school, you know, independent study that was all about liminality. And a lot of that came into the work that I was doing there, of like this idea that really, I mean, primarily came from Victor Turner and this idea of like the spectrum between ritual and theater and this magical space where, you know, all bets are off, all rules are elasticized, and actual transformation can happen. And I've always been really interested in writing that does that, and then in you know, actual experiential spaces that are created in that way, and the temporary autonomous illness obviously tied into that as well. And so there were a lot of different projects that did that. There was you know, Crystal and Spore is kind of a legendary one, which was this crew of us that did these kind of multimedia performances where there were a couple of us on microphones speaking, and then a live mixed stream of video projection, and then a couple of mover, ritualist, dancer performers all kind of creating this, we called it metamedia environment, that was really focused around kind of cultural critique and ideas about the culture itself. And I was always really interested in kind of enacting things as you're talking about them. That's, you know, and so for me, you know, the pinnacle of that was definitely Synergenesis, which was this annual event that I did for 3 years that for me really kind of tied in everything I was thinking about. I was really interested in creating an event where there was only really kind of one thing happening at a time. I felt like, you know, in the traditional festival environment, there's just millions of things happening all at the same time, and everyone's having really different experiences. And for my real interest, I was like, okay, well, what happens if we're all having the same kind of general shared collective experience all day for one day? And this was more of an urban event. It wasn't an outdoor thing. It was held at Cell Space the first time, and then at other kind of large gallery spaces around the city in San Francisco. And the way that it went is there was a huge group art show, each time like 25 plus artists, a couple of site-specific installations. So the whole space was really created to be art-oriented. And then there would be a series. The final one was really the one that, you know, I felt came together truly. So there would be a couple of speakers in the beginning of the day, and, you know, on really different things. So it started with Sibon Pousome, who was kind of, she brought in kind of traditional indigenous spirituality and did this whole kind of ritual with everyone and got everyone together and focused after speaking. She spoke about, you know, her ways and her practices. She's from Burkina Faso. She's an amazing woman. And then that went into Mark Lakeman, who's the, you know, urban permaculturist from Portland, who started Portland City Repair and talking about urban permaculture and kind of that angle of things. And then after him was Paul Laffoley, who, you know, some of you probably know is this kind of enigmatic genius from who got kicked out of Harvard Architecture School for claiming to have an alien implant in his brain. And he's an amazing artist, you know, high concept graphic work. And so there was that flow with sessions in between each of them with their kind of protégés leading what we called integration sessions, which was a chance for people to really try to engage with and work with what was being presented from the speaker. So that was kind of the morning. And then there was this transitional phase with where Saul Williams just threw down for 45 minutes without stopping. The whole room was dead silent. It was really amazing. And so there was this kind of moving into this transitional poetic space. And then from there was some music. We were moving into more kind of like a dance space. And first there was an acoustic, you know, Taryn on the banjo, kind of ragamuffin Tom Waits style. And then Deru, who's a live producer, really amazing, intricate, intelligent electronic music. And then there was a 45-minute performance piece that we did that was the Fool's Journey through the Major Arcana of the Tarot Deck, full theatrical performance. And then after that, there was Spork, which was this old incarnation of Hua from the Glitch Mob and Jamie Janover and, you know, this kind of, like, electronic jam fusion band. What I always found at Synergenesis that was so cool was that by the time we got to that final dance floor, everyone was dancing with everybody else in this way where it felt like all these different parts of our intelligence had gotten activated all day. All these really interesting conversations were happening, and we were really in it together. And it really felt like there was something happening that felt really different from anything I had experienced at any other party. And I received that reflection from a lot of people, actually.
Well, the thing that strikes me about that, I mean, I just think about that category of the curator. And, you know, people have talked a lot about how that's sort of, you know, while there have always been curators, you know, at least for a long time, that there's something particular about our culture now where the act of curation has more potential, has more creativity, and is more necessary in a lot of ways to kind of help people map the sort of multiple discourses and experiences that are coming their way, we're also overwhelmed that environments or even, you know, websites or art shows or that are well curated, they're often what makes them most interesting to me when curation is really happening is where there is a real divergence of sources, but somehow some possible space is like sketched in between. And that's true even if just an art show or a conference where you're just hearing talks. But what you've done, that event definitely stands out in my mind as well, is to sort of include within that curational framework different kinds of experiences. So people are listening, people are talking, people are hanging out, people are, you know, hearing music, people are dancing to music, people are, you know, invited in different ways to a kind of spectacle or a kind of theater, and so that you're engaging different parts of our experience as well. And that always seemed to me as one of the richest things about that whole, the festival culture in general, is that there's so many different kinds of experiences, some of which are quite powerful that people have, and if you create these sort of structures, that you can kind of guide or set up certain resonances that people wouldn't necessarily find or be driven to. Anyway, so it's this interesting balance of like not too much control, but still, you know, enough of a map. And I'm curious, just as you work with this, in a variety of different contexts, many different events, many different festivals, what was some of the rules of thumb that you developed over the years for the best way to kind of integrate these different sorts of, you know, sources and emotions and things?
That's a really interesting question. It's always been a really intuitive process for me. You know, there's definitely, I was always trying to push the levels of participation for sure. That was primary, always, was how can I have this be as little of like an audience performer dynamic as possible, knowing that that's a place people feel really comfortable in and will revert to if you let them.
Right.
So you have to really kind of be creative in how you convince people to get involved. And or kind of make it impossible for them not to get involved, really.
Well, it's interesting because that dynamic, I mean, it's really like the difference between going to see a concert, like, I mean, I don't know, like, not to be gnarly on her or whatever, but like Cat Power, right, she's just like singing the song, kind of hides from everyone, and no one's really, it's almost like you're voyeuristically peeping in on her private moment, and then going to a show where like the person comes into the audience and they stage dives and everyone's like on the stage, or like when I went to go see The Faint or like, you know, some of those bands, everyone just goes up on the stage and they all interact together, which some of those have like quite a bit of level of danger, honestly, but there's that schism where it's like, how do you get the participation, you know, and those are the concerts you remember the most, right, where there's some involvement between you and the person on the stage or the thing that's happening, and how do you, what's that, like, kind of balance, like you said, that creative, intuitive balance of, like, getting to that edge and not quite going into danger zone, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and, you know, when you're young and, you know, carefree or whatever, then sometimes the danger zone is kind of where you want to be, or at least close to it, you know? I mean, a lot, what eventually grew out of this is myself and my kind of working partner, Isis, Indria, started developing these kind of ritual workshops because we really wanted to keep pushing the level of participation. And we had been doing a lot of kind of ritual theater performances, and we just, we're like, we need less audience, more collectivity. And so we started doing these workshops, the first of which we did at the legendary Glade Festival, which you were at as well, Eric, which was just a ridiculous mud fest. But we had a really amazing experience there, particularly, I think, because it was the Glade Festival in the UK, which is not a West Coast underground gathering. It's a mainstream UK festival. So there were just people like taking shots of nitrous and diving headfirst into piles of mud. And And we were really trying to engage people on this more kind of like mystic level of taking them on this kind of initiatory journey. We were using the Tree of Life as a structure, and we just kept kind of pushing those boundaries of really trying to find a way to create transformative experience for people. And that was kind of the direction that we went in eventually, was really focusing more on things like that.
Yeah, that was a very interesting experience for me. I was because you invited me to participate, and I'd mostly been sort of on the edge of your working group. Like, I knew some of them well and some not so well, and most of them not very much at all. And that time was the one where I got to be a little bit more involved and sort of woven into it. And it was really remarkable how for, especially for the people who were really, you know, performing and throwing themselves into the experience, just a certain kind of community, a certain kind of connection that was created there that I think is really powerful. Reminds me also of some of the original operas that Pepe Ozon did at Burning Man, you know, from the middle of the 90s through the, you know, the end of the decade. One of the things they did there is that, you know, there were these massive quote unquote operas where you'd have hundreds of people, you know, doing fire spinning and doing different performances and whatever. And they didn't always work so well for the observers, for the audience. But the people, the more I found out about the people who were inside them, and some of them, you know, go through a week-long process, sometimes a month-long process of, you know, there would be alchemical symbolism and different kinds of god forms and different kinds of songs and different ways that people would sort of weave themselves into the deep kind of performance space. And so it's a really fascinating thing, but I'm hearing that music, that means we got to take our break here. So we'll be right back with Eve Bradford. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau, and stay tuned.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau, and we're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking to Eve Bradford. And we're talking about kind of group events, and before the break you started mentioning just about some of the rituals and things like that you do in groups and communities, and I do group ritual events, and I've even done like kind of mock sacrifices and things like that with, you know, participation in the audience. And I was curious, for you, in your events, you know, one of the big kind of things, well, not everyone's always going to participate. There's always like the looky-loos and then stragglers on the outside. But I was curious if when you do your big scale rituals and you open that liminal space, you know, and have that kind of acceptable degree of participation, have you had any kind of demonic hecklers show up in those spaces? Like, have you had any kind of strange things happen that maybe weren't necessarily like everyone was joined in a group consciousness level and everything was awesome and then everyone was cool? Or was there some where you had someone like the crazy person at the Grateful Dead show that has a freak out?
There's never been quite that level of like full crisis mode freak out. There's definitely been times when it felt like a lot to hold. I don't tend to go into really like full-on deep ritual in that context. I'm pretty, there's like, for me, there's kind of different layers of ritual practice and different forums which those layers are appropriate to. And again, you know, that there's that spectrum from ritual to theater. It's a spectrum, you know, for everywhere from like deep full-on ritual to straight theatrical performance, and there's a lot of space in between them.
Right.
And I'm really interested in that spectrum and many different places on it, and hanging out in different places on it with different groups of people. It's, you know, in different environments and different gatherings. It's really for me about honing and refining what is appropriate to different contexts.
And have you ever like gotten sick after doing one of those, or just been like totally annihilated? Has that ever happened?
No, I've definitely been depleted. I've been exhausted, but I've never gotten like wrecked from it. No.
Right. What was kind of one of them, were there any, like, on the other end of the spectrum where you led a ritual like that and it really kind of profoundly changed you as a result from interacting with the audience in that manner?
Definitely. I would say usually.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's part of why I do it, really. You know, I mean, I was thinking over the break how I felt like perhaps this was coming across as, like, a very intellectual pursuit for me. But and I can easily kind of go into that more kind of, like, intellectual place because I like the mind and I like thinking about things in that way. But really, like, a lot of this is coming from this really, like, deep craving for, a spiritually based community, a shared community practice that is not just about the kind of mundane everyday existence. And I've been seeking that in one way or another really since childhood. I mean, I grew up as a, you know, hippie Jew, and what in sixth grade became a fundamentalist born again Christian for a couple of years. And, you know, and then it went on from there, from like being a phone psychic to be, I mean, there's been a lot of stops along the way. And I really have, I realize when I look at it, I've been seeking this like spirit-based community experience in one way or another all throughout. And it's really for the love, for the feeling of, you know, that place you're talking about where after a really powerful group, shared group ritual experience, there's really nothing like it in my experience. There's no other experience like that than the kind of quality of connection and of awareness and of presence that exists in that space.
Well, and let me ask you this, because this is something I think about a lot, is like, as I do those events and the other kind of group events that, like I said, just make my skin crawl, what do you feel is the difference between a very kind of focused, intentful, organized group event like the ones you're talking about, and then just kind of most of the failed group events like you were mentioning earlier that didn't quite like make it, didn't quite get to that spot where everyone was just there and kind of participating, but it didn't quite reach that level? Like, what do you think is present in one that's not in the other that kind of flips it like past that and gets it to the good spot?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to try to wrap words on. I think there's a combination.
Let me just try one aspect of it. I mean, it's only one aspect of it. It is about the crowd and the kind of intentionality. I mean, you're you know, it's one thing to try to do this at a massive commercial, music festival like Glade, where you have all these sort of other worlds and very different ways of being, and you can only expect a certain degree of sort of openness from the crowd in general. There'll be individuals who are drawn to it, and they'll be open. But you know, a lot of the time when it really works, it's probably because that the individuals who are there are seeking themselves. You know, that they have some of that that actual intention, and you can use group intention to clarify and enchant in a good way the kind of performance. I know, even just like as a lecturer, when I give a talk, you know, and I don't script my talks. It's pretty improv. And when I'm talking to like hungry like minds, like some talks I've given to Burning Man, I can't believe some of the stuff that comes. I've never said that before. Wow, that's great. That's a beautiful phrase. Oh, who's doing that? But if I'm in front of a hostile crowd or a boring crowd or a distracted crowd, it's not the same. So there's something about the fact that one of the things about these neo-tribal festivals, especially the smaller ones, but even the larger scale ones, is you're going to have a good number of people who are coming there seeking on some level for the same thing that you're talking about. And so when they see the opportunity, it's like, oh, here's the opportunity to like throw my sacred desire into the mix. To even if I'm just standing on the side, I'm going to like acknowledge and kind of like allow this to be more than just a bunch of people in costumes, you know, running through some performance game or whatever. And so it seems like partly what you're doing with these groups too is also like teaching or allowing the people who come to these events to understand that they can come to them at different levels, and the different levels they plug in, they'll get rewarded in different ways. So it's like a learning process over time. And that leads me to my next question, is that you've been doing this for a while now, you know, a good solid decade. And where have you come to with that? I mean, I know, you know, we talked a little bit, we don't have tons of time left, but we talked a little bit about the Haven Underground, which is a, you know, a community, you know, on the ground, you know, day-to-day community environment that you co-founded in the last couple of years. How has your sort of sense of the need for sacred community kind of changed and sort of moved through the festival thing, but maybe moved a little bit beyond it as well?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's that combination of meticulous preparation and being completely surrendered to the flow. That's probably would be my answer to that last question. And the way that that has moved in my life is like from these events, I started to get a little disillusioned, I have to say, because I was pouring myself into this work and not necessarily feeling super received all the time. It sometimes felt like I was trying to force people to go to school when they just wanted to go to a party. And so I took some space for myself. I was feeling like I needed a break from the culture, and I needed to kind of regroup and see what I was really about and see what was I actually seeking? What was I actually trying to create? Because it started to feel like what was happening wasn't quite the thing. It was getting towards the thing. And so I left the city. I got some land with my brother, and we are, you know, we've started this community center in Nevada City called Haven Underground that is a venue for all kinds of things, workshops and dance classes and music events, dance parties, all kinds of things, gallery space as well. And so it's a place that is kind of a chance, and I, you know, I run it with a couple of people, including Isis, who I've been doing this work with forever. And, you know, so we're kind of experimenting with what it looks like to be in a continual community over time and really build community and begin to build a foundation together of people that are doing consistent work together and sharing land together, growing food together, kind of taking it out of the temporary autonomous zone and into daily life. I'm sure it's a sign of getting older that becomes more important to me. I'm really exploring what it looks like to be doing that work consistently with a smaller, consistent group of people, which is challenging in different ways and rewarding in different ways, for sure. And then I've also been really deepening my own studies. I've been working with a teacher, Martine Brechtel, in New Mexico, and my own just kind of studies of a lot of indigenous cultures and of ways of kind of forgotten histories and really getting into, okay, what was it I was seeking there? What is it I think a lot of us are seeking, which is this kind of village life that the only place, the closest we get to experiencing it is at a week-long festival. It's this way of being with each other that feels very, very old to me, actually, and that we don't have a lot of access to in contemporary modern life and is really, I think, for myself personally, and I think for a lot of other people, is really at the heart of what we're seeking there, as well as kind of ecstatic experience. But there's something about being with each other and working together and in this way that feels very elusive, I think, presently. And so I'm really trying to find ways to create that now in a more tangible, consistent way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great challenges there, and, you know, we've talked about this too in the past, is just that, you know, when you look at, you know, our tribal cultures, pre-modern cultures, you know, it's so much of the rule set of the agreements, of the intentions that enable people to have that sense of continuity, of depth, of a kind of meaningful social matrix that's imaginative as well as, you know, everyday. But you know that's just what they're brought up in. You know, it's there already. You're in that world, and maybe it changes a little bit, and maybe there's an encounter between different, you know, tribes or different teachers. But you know that people have that kind of advantage to a great degree. But that's not what we get. And you know, when you think about whether you're thinking about the specific symbolism that you would use in a ritual, like, just do people understand this? Do they know what the Tree of Life is? Is it an effective symbol to bring people together at this scale or a smaller scale, or what scale is it working at, those kinds of things. And then also just for that life ways, that village life culture. So can you give me like a thought or two or an example of how, as you go through all the everyday challenges of setting up an existing, you know, a long-standing community, some of the ways that you're trying to create that sense of a kind of a really shared culture that can, in some ways, bring people into it or even be passed on to others?
Yeah, definitely having just regular time where we come together and share space in a way that is not, you know, again, it's me, the content junkie, you know, that has content orientation. So we come together and craft together, or we come together and share skills. You know, that it's not just the only time we all get together is to party and then the rest of the time we're off doing our thing. That there's this way in which other aspects of life are shared. I've just been talking with a group of people about ways, you know, there's a lot of people here who are working to cultivate land, and ways that we can share work days where we move from place to place and each really put in time on each other's land, because so much more is accomplished when you're with a group of people. And the other way is really shared regular ritual. Very, you know, I've been working more closely lately with Starhawk, which has been really great for me, really amazing, and really value her as a teacher. And really learning about very accessible, tangible, practical magic in this way where we can share it as a community. It's not tons of smoke and mirrors. It's not super theatrical, and it's definitely not based in the ego. It's really based in being of service and in figuring out ways to be consistently, collectively participating in the multidimensional nature of reality together. And developing a shared vocabulary around that and shared practices around that, where it just becomes part of how you live. I mean, that's the thing that I recognize about what I'm craving in village life, is that there's an integration of practical work and magical practice and, you know, spiritual being and creativity and joy all together. And so really working as best I can to, it really has a lot to do with knowing the stories of the place where you are, I think, and really knowing the plants and the animals and the people who are there before you and what's happened here. And if everyone has this shared real knowing of the stories of the tools you use and the food you eat and the clothes you wear and where everything came from and what it's holding, then suddenly you're living in a web of stories, and the existence that you're participating in is so much more rich.
Well, that's really where, like, religions spring out of, right? That's why we have, like, the Bible and people go to synagogue, or, you know, we get churches and people come together in communities to really kind of formulate those kind of experience and get to some kind of communal root with it and be able to share it in practices and stories and, you know. I mean, do you feel like for you it's like religion?
I mean, no. Not really. It doesn't, I mean, if religion is like institutionalized spirituality, it depends on how you're defining religion, I guess, but I think it's more just like shared practice, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to create, you know, in that way, I think it has something in common with religion, that idea of like a shared practice and like some common ground, but, you know, it's being created from the ground up, because we're really kind of spiritual orphans, most of us, you know, and so we're just figuring it out as we go.
Yeah, I think that's a huge difference. I mean, it's more about practice than agreeing on a kind of belief structure, and where the practice itself is the creation of practice that will have these effects. So it's not just like everyone's doing their own thing. It's that part of the practice is, how do we come together? How do we create rituals that will have these effects in producing this more multi-dimensional life? And, you know, in a way it is traditional, and in a way it's not traditional. And the spiritual orphan model is really great. But listen, we don't have very much time left, and I wanted to give you a little bit of time to talk about the huge, kind of amazing-looking festival that you're working on. It's coming up very soon, which I wish I could be at, but I won't be able to. Symbiosis, which is going to be held in Pyramid Lake in Nevada, which folks who've gone to Burning Man should recognize. So what's up with that? What's been your involvement there?
Well, it's I was invited in to help create the ceremonial container for this event. It's been a really profound learning experience, particularly in the last couple of weeks. You know, it's on the Paiute Reservation, Pyramid Lake Reservation, and we've been learning a lot about what it is to actually receive permission to be on Native land in this way, and that there's a lot that the producers didn't know about tribal politics and the kind of the difference between tribal council and the traditional elders. And we've just been in a profound learning experience around all of that, and it's been incredible, actually. It's been really educational and really amazing, I think, to kind of break the historical trend of you know, white folks coming in and kind of ignoring when the local Native people have an issue with what they're doing. And there's been a lot of effort on the part of everyone to really listen and integrate the needs and the desires and the wishes and the issues raised by the local Native people. It's been an incredible process. I was just on site yesterday speaking with people there about how we can be holding the ceremonies in a way that feels good to the people there and how they can participate and be a part of it. And naturally, there's a full mixed range of how people feel about this happening there. But at its heart, this festival is really, it's centered around a full solar eclipse that's happening on Sunday, the 20th. That's the real purpose for the event. And you know, it's, again, it's the next step in the evolution of this culture, really trying to reach a higher level of intentionality, a higher level of integrity. And it's no accident to me that we're all getting kind of collectively schooled because it is on a reservation, and we're needing to really look at ourselves and look at our culture and see how we show up, see the way we affect the land, see the way we affect the places where we have these gatherings, and really evaluate them and get real about what would it look like to do this with the highest integrity possible in service to something other than just our own good time. And it's been really powerful. So, yeah, we're deep in the preparations for that right now. And, yeah, I don't know if you have more specific questions about what's going on there. Or...
Well, you know, I just it's the whole thing is fascinating to me. But I'm curious how you how have you worked with the tribal elders in terms of either, you know, crafting appropriate ritual or learning really what they need or at least some of them need to feel in terms of it being intentional. Like, what have you learned about that process? Because it is, you know, it's not, you know, there's so much of the opposite. There's so much of the, you know, New Age colonialism, and so when you're actually trying to engage, you suddenly realize there's all they're full of politics too, and they have people across the spectrum, and then there's those people who you're really connecting or resonating with, and I'm curious, like, how that interaction has gone.
Yeah, it's been really layered and nuanced, but definitely some of the most key things that I've learned is really trying to get hyper meticulous about the assumptions that are coded into even the best intentioned kind of imperial mindset. So not just even inviting a traditional person to be a part of a festival, but acknowledging first, you might not want to be, I can see that you might not want to be a part of this, that it might not feel comfortable for you to be a part of this. So what can I do to help make it more comfortable for you to want to be involved? You know, really getting aware of that, even to assume that they would want to have anything to do with this is a big assumption, you know, and really trying to see what I can do to create an environment where they feel welcomed and where they feel comfortable and where they feel like there is actually space for their voices to be heard and for their ways to be honored. That's been a huge part of the learning process for me, and really listening, really not trying to come in there and get defensive and talk really quickly about where I'm coming from and everything that I want, but just coming in and being quiet and leaving space for the traditional people to speak as best I can. I mean, sometimes it's difficult to even track them down. That's been a lot of the work, too, is trying to find the people to talk to, because it's not like they're just hanging out waiting to talk to you. It's definitely a treasure hunt, you know?
Well, we're going to have to end it there because we got to wrap up. I want to let people know they can check out more about Symbiosis at pyramideclipse.com, and Eve's website is ladyapples.com. Eve, thanks so much. It's been so great talking to you, especially after not having done it for a couple of years. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Eric.
Thanks, Eve.
Thank you.
All right. From me and Maj to all y'all, keep your minds open.